There we go. Okay, good morning, guys. It's Thursday, the 7th of August, 2025. Pete, what number is this?
Daughter Smoke 261. Crank it in, Robert. Crank it in, Ralph.
Crank it in, guys, and we'll soon forget what crank it in means, but then Pete will remind us. And
I've
anyway,
already forgotten.
but they're going to crank it in, Robert and Ralph. There you go. All right. Listen, I just thought we'd open this show, this podcast. First of all, I am in Shada Smoke Shack South. I'm down here in the Dominican Republic, and I put a map up. I got a map. You'll see it on the Blogspot. There's a red dot that shows me in the Dominican Republic. There's a red dot that shows Denver, Colorado, where Pete was, and there's a red dot up near Anchorage, Alaska, where Dean is going. So anyway, that is kind of our travelogue portion of the show. And you guys got any comments about your destinations or where you were?
Well, I'll mention that I had a couple surprising things happen to me in on a trip to Denver, Colorado. Spent about a week there with my youngest son. It was a very exciting trip. Got to see a lot of things that everyone should see. It just amazing things here in the United States. One thing that struck me was courtesy. I have seen such courtesy in my life. We were in the motel. And we got up to the door of the elevator, was about to close, and this arm comes out and says, "I'm holding the elevator for you." This was California. They pushed the button and closed the door on you. Little kids. We were in the zoo, and they had some areas that you could open these gates because they actually had animals running around, like some peacocks and some wallabies. And I'm walking up there, and this young kid says, "I'll get the gate for you." And he opens the gate for me. And so I said, "Thank you." And he said, "You're very welcome." I have never seen such courtesy. It was so dramatic, different from California. I mean, California, they slam the gate on you, you know.
We got to get you out of LA, Pete.
I mean, it was so noticeable, and service. Like you go into restaurants, some of these people, servers come up to you and is like, "Hey, I'm doing you a favor, I'm gonna serve you," instead greeting you. I mean, it was just a noticeable change, and it was just something about it that I had never seen before. So it stands out, and I just said, "Well, that's amazing. There are people still who are courteous today." So that was a big takeaway from
It
the
was
trip.
great. I'm glad you had get a good trip. It looks like you had a great trip. And then we're gonna shift now to the guy who has the San Francisco Clint Eastwood poster standing up behind him with Dirty Harry saying, "Make my day."
Make my day, which is what I say to my radio equipment all day long when I'm working on it. Make my day, come on. So we are headed to Anchorage, Alaska for a couple of weeks. I have my son is there and daughter-in-law and our one-year-old granddaughter. So we are looking forward to that. This is one of those trips where essentially nothing is planned except hanging out with the family, although the kids have arranged a trip up near Denali for us for a long weekend. We rented a cabin up there, so that should be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that.
That's great. It sounds like a
Do
terrific trip.
they live there now permanently? Is that where they're
Yeah,
located?
they moved to Anchorage earlier this year. They're actually buying a house from my daughter-in-law's parents, so they actually live right across the street from her parents in the house she grew up in. So it's a,
Wow, how
yeah.
exciting.
And in Anchorage, if you've never been to Anchorage, first of all, Alaska is huge. First of all, it's enormous. And you don't really get a sense of it from any map because it's always stuck off in the corner next to Hawaii or somewhere on a map. But it's like as big as a third of the United States. It's enormous of the continental 48. Anchorage is a fair-sized city, but in a state that doesn't have a huge population. They live only about 10 minutes from the airport, and they live on a lake, and you feel like you're like in a remote part of the country. It's very nice.
Sounds so cool. Mike WU2D took his summer vacation in Alaska, and he's been making videos with a sweatshirt that says Alaska on the front. So it seems like it's a thing. I hope you have a good trip, Dean. Hey, we want to say a few words here about the future of the podcast. Dean and I have been talking about this quite a bit about the impact of AI And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. But there have been a number of posts recently on about how AI is going to lead to the demise of the internet as we know it, how readership in blogs and other podcasts are in decline. But we, I think, have all made a collective decision here to embrace our NIMCEL status. Pete and I were the original NIMCELs. Dean joined after the whole NIMCEL thing. And I had to explain what NIMCEL meant. It all comes from a New York Times article, which so it must be true. NIMCEL stands for Net Internet Micro Celebrity, right? Micro is the key word. No, niche. Niche Internet Micro Celebrity. So niche is a key word and micro is a key word. And so I think we will continue here to do this thing that we do. Even if there are only one or two listeners out there, we'll hold on. We're gonna defy the odds. We're gonna fight the machine, and stick with our NIM, embrace our NIMCEL status. We had to,
Bill, I have a
yeah.
question for you. Are you saying that AI killed the podcast star?
I'm
Is that
saying
what you're saying?
AI is a serious threat, because Dean, here's why. Because even you and I. And I'm sure Pete is doing it. I know Pete is doing it too. You Google something and it lists a whole bunch of websites down below, but it gives you this nice little box that says Google Gemini search. And it gives you the answer. It says yes, no, yes, you're
Although
right. No.
lately they have been adding according to the Solder Smoke podcast,
Well, then you know it must be true. So anyway, but the result is, this is what's referred to as the AI apocalypse, because people are not going to the websites that Google used to send them to. People used to do a Google search. Google would list a whole bunch of sites. Some of the sites would be your sites, and people would go there. This is not that important to us because we're not depending on the websites or the Blogspot pages for our livelihood. But for people who are, it's devastating, because they would previously get 2,000 visitors a day. Now they're getting maybe 200. And of
Or
the 200,
two,
or
or
of the
two.
two of the 200, 198 might be bots, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of scary. But I think we should fight on and embrace our NIMCEL status. I had to explain, we had our doubts about the whole NIMCEL thing. First of all, it sounded a lot like incel. All right, which, no, that's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And we don't want that. And then it sounded an awful lot like numbskull. NIMCEL, numbskull? No, we didn't want that either. But there it is. It's the acronym. It's been in the New York Times. So we're going to fight on and embrace our NIMCEL status. Thanks a lot to Peter, VK3TPM, and Hamilton, especially KD0FNR, who are helping me prepare for the demise of Blogspot. It hasn't been announced, but Google has a habit of doing this kind of thing, where all of a sudden, even though you've invested a lot of time, and the Solder Smoke blog has more than 3,000, I think close to 4,000 posts, 10,000 comments in there, and poof, it could disappear tomorrow. So Peter especially has been very successful in engineering a solution that would migrate the site, the Solder Smoke Blogspot page, the whole blog of Solder Smoke, and move it into a non-Google website. We've got it; it's done, and we're tweaking it. Hamilton's worked on something similar, using what's the what's what's where did he put it, Dean? He put it in where? What's the one that's used for all the internet stuff where people put this?
WordPress.
No, there's another one. I forget. Jesus,
I don't know.
I'm
I don't
having one of these
remember.
moments now. It's early in the morning. But anyway, Hamilton helped out with that. And
How
we
about the
were,
Wayback Machine?
no, not the way, we have that. That's another backup we have. We have the
Yeah.
Wayback Machine. But, GitHub. There you go.
GitHub. There you
GitHub.
go.
Hamilton was doing it on GitHub. Sam AI7PR offered to do it. Todd K7TFC has been providing a lot of good comments and suggestions. We do have the Wayback Machine that's providing a backup. So we feel secure that we're not going to suddenly find Google killing the Solder Smoke blog. There are a number of blogs of copies of it out there already. And so thanks for that. But it is a scary reality that Google could end the blog the whole blog business any minute, as they've done with other things in the past. So we're prepared for it, and we are going to embrace that at NIMSELF status. We're going to hang in there. Hey, we won an award, Dean.
We did.
And it's the 2025 ARRL Technical Service Award. Thanks to Bruce KC1FSZ for nominating us for this award. And thanks to the ARRL for letting us know. Bill Marine, N2COP, called on the phone and let us know. And this is because of our work with the Discord server. It happened during a time when Pete was extremely busy and didn't get involved in it. But this was the time when we were talking about the solder smoke direct conversion receiver challenge, in which we took the challenge that we had originally presented to the local high school students who failed, and we presented it to the broader worldwide amateur radio community. So far, 91 receivers have been completed. They've been built in 15 countries, and this has received some, I think, very, very pleasing recognition on the part of the ARRL, who've given us the 2025 ARRL Technical Service Award. So congratulations to you, Dean.
And to you, Bill.
Well, I you know those vids.
Congratulations, guys. Good
Thanks.
job.
Thank you guys. It was Dean did a wonderful job in presenting how to build the receiver. I mean, the videos that he did were just brilliant. And then anytime somebody runs into a problem, we find ourselves finding a nice way to say, go take a look at the videos. You'll see how to do
We try. They don't always take the bait.
it.
When I was talking to Bill Marine about the award, I said, we were skeptical when we got nominated that ARRL would recognize it because it has felt like a backwater technical area of the hobby for some time, and I was really pleased that ARRL is embracing and endorsing kind of our low tech approach. There's no in this particular build, it's all analog, it's all discrete component, and that was intentionally so, as we've talked about before. And he said, it takes us all back to the roots of the hobby. And I said, that's exactly why we wanted to do it, because we want to encourage more people to do that.
And yeah, and the other thing that's been really gratifying along the same lines is how many folks who are really more high tech in their professional orientation or even in their amateur radio orientation, they remark that the receiver really sounds great. And not only that, it's very, very sensitive. We had one guy do some minimal discernible signal tests and determined that the thing is super, super sensitive, and it'll pick up just about anything. So that was really good, and thanks. I just think it's great that like you said, Dean, that the ARRL has recognized this kind of what could be seen as kind of a retro effort,
And we have everyone from first-time builders who don't even have a license yet, to guys who've had their licenses for decades, to I guess the most distinguished person we have is an MIT radio astronomer.
That's right. We have an actual observatory. That's the next item on the agenda here, because this was one of the big events of the summer. We Dean and I here at Solder Smoke East were pleased to host Phil W1PJE. He is the distinguished MIT radio astronomer, the head of the Haystack Observatory of MIT, and involved in a lot of really cutting edge stuff. And he was making his way up I-95, heading back up to the Boston area, and he was kind enough to take a detour to Solder Smoke East, and we sat around. We did an interview with him. Also, and as Dean has indicated, he is a member of the Hall of Fame, the Solder Smoke Direct Conversion Receiver Hall of Fame. He actually built one of these receivers, and he is a for real radio amateur who started out as a shortwave listener. We'll talk about that when we get to the mailbag. But it was really great to see Phil come in, and we did a nice video of 15 minutes or so talking to Phil about radio astronomy and the direct conversion receiver. So that was a lot of fun. Dean, you've got a lot to talk about. You got to tell us about the amplifier. I have here on the agenda amplifier design Woes, Triumphs, Tribal Knowledge, there it is, and Help from Claude. So tell us
Oh
about it,
yeah.
Dean.
Oh yeah. So this for those listening, not watching on YouTube, this is a well, let's say this is intended to be a 100-watt amplifier that works across HF. It uses two RD100 HHF1 transistors. And if you've ever built a push-pull MOSFET amplifier, you'll recognize that the circuits are very simple. I mean, you have an input side that has a transformer that takes the 50 ohm input to whatever the input impedance of your push-pull pair is. Usually you use a 4-to-1, so you present about 12 ohms to each gate. You have a bias circuit which provides the DC bias, unlike a NPN transistor. The MOSFET is voltage controlled, so you have to apply a voltage to the gate. And you want to, where you put that bias determines the class of the amplifier. That's the most important thing about that. And then you have the transistors themselves arranged in a push-pull pair, and then you have an output transformer, which usually or generally also includes the DC path for the drain current. So you have to provide drain current to the drains, that's it. I mean, those, and a power supply with filtering, right? So you'd say, well, all right, that's pretty easy. That's just three or four simple areas. This amplifier works great up to about 18, 17, 18 megahertz, and then it gradually drops off. And by the time it gets to 28 megahertz, it's not an amplifier anymore. It's an attenuator. I have when I first posted a design of this up on the BitExpo. Now, this is another thing that has happened. I've noticed just since I've been a radio amateur, there are less places on the internet for active discussion of homebrew projects. Now, when I first started, you could go to the BitX20 forum, and everybody was doing mods to their BitXs. Everyone was coming up with new circuits. They were building AGC circuits and all this kind of. Now, it's all about the software for the ZBitX and or the SBitX, and that's fine. But you post and you don't get very many responses. There's another group called for amateur radio builders who build things, and I'm like, okay, that's perfect. I posted a question on there. I got zero response. I did get a response on the BitX board, so I was really pleased that some of the old timers like Allison KB1GMX came back. And Allison is a very sharp radio engineer, but her advice sometimes is rather pointed. When I posted a photograph of the amplifier, the first thing she said was, "Dean, could you make the leads any longer?" Like, okay.
Well, yes, I could.
If I tried, I could. I read through her advice, and I kind of, when I first built it, there were several things going on. It was like any feedback was killing the amplification. So you have an, yeah, that's the other thing I didn't mention. Between the drain and the gate, you have a feedback circuit because they're feedback amplifiers and you need feedback for stability in MOSFET amplifiers. And at first, almost any feedback I put in was killing the amplifier. And that turned out to be the problem that Allison was talking about. I had way too much stray inductance because I had really long leads coming in and out of the transformers. I had capacitors with longish leads. I had the feedback circuits not mounted directly from the gates and the drains. So I spent a fair amount of time tightening up everything. So in the current version, the input and the output transformers, they come from Communications Concepts, same place that Bill and Pete have bought their amp kits from before. I use the same transformer cores they're using, with slightly different windings to get the impedance right. But they're actually soldered directly to the board, to the traces on the board. So there's no leads anymore on the transistor side of the amplifier, just soldered directly to traces. And I, tightened up all the leads. I put the feedback directly across the drains and gates, but I'm still struggling to get it to work above about 20 megahertz. And these transistors should work way up into like 6 meters. And so The latest suggestions are go buy a bunch of fairly expensive RF surface mount caps and replace all the capacitors with these RF surface mount caps. And on the Mitsubishi application note for the which has an example circuit, they actually solder there's capacitors that go between the drains that help balance out the transformer, and they actually solder the surface mount caps directly to the transformer core end pieces. There are two PCB pieces on the end of the transformer core, and I have three ceramic caps twisted together and soldered directly to the same place. So I mean, I could eliminate, I don't know, an eighth of an inch of more wiring with these kind of zero inductance caps, but I don't think it's going to make a difference even if I do that. Other suggestions have been, well, I've got these longish traces on the board that might be separating the ground plane and causing ground differentials that at lower frequencies aren't making a difference, but at higher frequencies are. So it's been suggested that I put it on a double-sided board and put the ground plane on the bottom and drill vias, and it's all more work than I wanted to do, but I also want to get it working. Of course, I don't really plan to operate on 10 meters very much. I probably will spend most of my time on 40, where I can get 150 watts out without too much trouble, and on 20 where I can get 110 or 125 watts. So, part of me is like, well, I'll just box it up and say, well, I got an amplifier that works on 40 and 20, but I'm stubborn, which is
Slightly
part of this.
reduced output on 10. Slightly reduced output on 10, right? Slightly reduced output.
If it was slightly reduced output, I'd be happy, Pete, but it's not. It's like the and I have done all the things that I know to do. And I get a lot of suggestions about, have you checked this? Have you checked that? And generally, yes, I have. I've been doing this now long enough that I kind of know the things to do. My brother's made a few suggestions, which has been nice. I get a lot of help from internet folks who've never built any amplifiers, who will comment confidently on things they know nothing about. I don't know. So if anybody has any suggestions as to why my amplifier would not be working well, and I have checked that I got the same level of drive at 10 meters from the driver stage. In fact, I have to increase the output on the signal generator to the driver stage because it isn't real linear up to 10 meters. But even with that, I can't detect anything wrong at any place in the circuit. So I'm down to kind of layout and components. I have type 43 ferrites in the input transformer, type 61 in the output transformer, but that doesn't really seem to matter either. I've swapped those, or I put type 43s in. I've tried different forms of transformers. I'm using essentially the identical circuit from the Mitsubishi application note, where they get 100 watts out easy across HF. So I'm puzzled, and I'm close to the fever dream stage, Bill. Tear it all
No,
apart.
that's where he's referring to the dream that we have, where you think a lot. I'm going to try to remove this one or two parts, and then you get carried away, and by the time you wake up, all the parts are removed from the board, and there's a big pile of dead parts and a completely bare PCB board. Don't do it, Dean. Don't do it.
Here's the other thing. These transistors are built into certain commercial transceivers, 100 watt transceivers. So I know that the commercial vendors have managed to make them work. Everybody's suggesting, or not everybody, Allison in particular is suggesting the layout's got to be much tighter. I really got to go to a manufactured PCB, eliminate all the traces, because stray inductance is her view is what's killing the amplifier. But I don't know. I'm puzzled. I've tried as many different things as I can. If you've seen a picture of my workbench, it is littered with different transformers, different capacitors, an earlier version. I have already done it once, Bill. I've already torn it apart and rebuilt it once. So I mean, the next one would require cutting a new PCB with a double-sided PCB with a solid ground plane on the bottom. And but I'm out of ideas.
I was just watching Curious Mark, who is a radio amateur, on his YouTube channel. He was trying to fix an old HP 180 series oscilloscope, and he really was screwing it up, and it wasn't working. And he had a DC probe to measure the 18,000 volts in this thing, 18 kilovolts. Wow. But he paused at one point and he said, "Don't get discouraged. This is our lot. We are made to suffer."
So you asked about Claude. So Claude is the AI chatbot by the Anthropic Corporation. Anthropic was a spin out of OpenAI. After OpenAI decided to abandon their, we're only doing AI for the public good and safety, and decide we're going to become a big for-profit company, a bunch of the engineers that founded OpenAI left and founded this company called Anthropic. And they've created their own version of the ethical chatbot called Claude. And Claude 4.0 is well regarded as being one of the best technical assistants for programmers. So I decided to test it out for RF design. And I've been having fun asking Claude about my amplifier problems. And Claude has made, some of the similar suggestions that the internet wizards have made, which is not too surprising because Claude is trained off the internet wizards. But I found it really interesting. It is a little bit obsequious though. You'll say things like, well, Claude, you got that impedance ratio wrong. And it'll say, oh, you are absolutely right. Thank you so much for correcting my error. Or you put in something, say, well, I made this change and the gain went from 10 dB to 12 dB. Excellent. You have solved the problem. It's like, no, I haven't yet, but thank you for that obsequious comment. I even told it at one time, stop being so informal. If that it can't help
You're right, I
itself.
am being too informal.
Yes, you're right. So anyway, I find that it is a useful tool if you are knowledgeable about the subject, because it still makes pretty significant simple errors, particularly in this area. Like, it can't seem to understand that a center tapped one turn transformer on a binocular core is actually a 0.5 turns ratio, right? And that's a concept that it can't get. So it constantly calculates the turns ratio and therefore the impedance ratio wrong. And I have to say to it, it's only 0.5 turns, not one turn to the, to, you know, on the, and it's, oh yes, you're absolutely right. And this obsequious agreement is a little disturbing because, if it's agreeing with me instantly after me telling it it's wrong, it's not analyzing whether I'm wrong or not.
But Dean, this is how a cult is born. You and Claude could form your own cult of 100 watt amplifiers.
If the number of people who have successfully built a receiver, despite our massive push, is 91, with us handholding every single one of them. The number of people who have actually homebrewed 100 watt solid state amplifier has got to be vanishingly smaller than that.
It's
So
much
there aren't a lot
smaller.
of people for me to ask for advice, is what it comes down to. So, and those that do, I do ask for advice, are very certain, but they've never built this amplifier. They've built other ones, but they've never built this one. So if anybody's built an amplifier with two RD100 HHF1s in a push-pull, I'd like to hear from them, and I'd like to know how you did it successfully up to 28 megahertz. I don't care what it does at 14 megahertz. Mine works perfectly at 14 megahertz.
Hey, Dean, I was going to ask a question. If
Yeah.
you've looked at the relative size of your board versus the other board, commercial boards, is it that significant? Is it just slightly larger, or is it like two times, or
It's
something like that?
slightly larger. I could make the active circuit tighter. I could tighten everything up more. And if I redo it, I've already got a CNC file. I can tighten all the traces up. You get too tight, it just gets hard to work on. So I ended up spreading it out a little bit, but
I was reminded of the guy who built an audio amplifier, and he had the volume control over one part of the chassis, and the leads were 3 feet long, and he
Yeah.
wondered why it oscillated, you know.
We've seen those. But yeah, I agree with you, Dean. At 28 megahertz, I mean, the difference between a board that's this big and a board that's this big, it's not like you're designing an amplifier for 5 gigahertz where that would be a big difference. This is not a lot of difference. So hang in there. I mean, I'm sure you're going to get it. I mean, I have never tried what you're trying to do. I mean, I have always wimped out and gone to CCI. I have two CCI amplifiers, the AN762 and the EB63A. But they are both because I was worried about my ability to produce a stable 100 watt solid state amplifier. So my hat's off to you. Hang in there. I'm sure you'll get
Stability is
it.
not a problem. It does not oscillate.
Yeah.
That I know for sure, but it does just dies as the frequency goes up. And
Yeah, that
slightly
attenuate.
reduced output. Slightly reduced output.
It becomes an attenuator. That's kind of more than
No,
slightly
you've seen those
attenuated.
commercial radios. It says 100 watts and slightly reduced output on 10 meters. So it's a common problem.
With no
Yeah, the other
explanation
thing I'll
either.
say is you don't do this to save money. Okay, so I could have bought a CCI amplifier, particularly because I killed one of these $50 transistors along the way and I had to replace it. I could have bought the CCI kit plus a plus the add the heat sink and so on for about what I've put into this, a little more. But so you're not really doing this to save money, and that's kind of not the point. I could buy it. I don't look, there's this is what we do. This is our hobby, right?
No, that's it.
We do it because it's interesting and we love to do it.
I agree with you. And I find myself saying all the time, okay, the rig here is homebrew, but when I start saying it's the 100 watts amplifier, that's kit built. I have to be honest. And I wish I could say that the entire chain was homebrew, but I'm not there. I'm not
You
quite there yet.
too could have this much fun, Bill.
I'm going to wait till you and Claude get it squared away.
Well, everybody keeps saying, "Will you post the schematic?" I'm like, "No, not till it's working."
We want the BOM. Where is the BOM? The
Well,
BOM.
actually, what I do is I send them to the Mitsubishi applicant. The Mitsubishi engineers were great. They have an application note that actually has a push-pull amplifier that has been tested up to above 28 megahertz. They measured IMD. It's a they show you a photograph of the board, so it's like they couldn't have been more helpful, and I still can't get it working right. So,
I'm sure you will. Hey, Pete, you've got a beautiful picture of the rig behind you. And I want to just say, I just noticed this when I was looking at it before. That's kind of a bad name. Is it Transcam?
calm.
Transcom. Okay, Transcom is better than Transcam because
Yeah.
Transcam sounds like it's a
Yeah.
scam. But
Yeah.
Transcom, that's tell us about that one, Pete. And we're going to talk we were going to say you're going to talk about Project X, the Transcom SBT3.
Yes. Well, first off, I first saw the Transcom SBT3 in the mid 60s, and it was advertised in CQ and QSD at the time, and I said, "Boy, that looks really cool." Then you didn't see anything more of it. And as I discovered, there are only about 500 of these radios built. And of the 500, 200 went to the Philippine government. The Philippine government bought it, and it just sort of disappeared from the face of the earth.
What year, Pete,
About
roughly?
1965,
Wow.
65. And the guy who started this worked for the usual companies. I think he even worked for Gonsett at one time. He and Herb Johnson both worked for Gonsett and other companies. And he was building these down in the San Diego area. And he had 10 employees. He had 10 women. So that tells you the size of the company. Pretty small. He was essentially doing all the engineering. It took him 2 years to develop this, and it didn't last too long in the marketplace. And broadly speaking, it's a three-band, tri-band, 100-watt radio. It's a hybrid rig. All the lower-level stages are solid state. and he has two 6146 like tubes in the final amplifier stage. And why I say that, it's like they're instant heating tubes. So essentially, when you hit the, it takes 1 second for the filaments to light. So you hit the push to talk switch, and a second later, you got RF into the antenna. And the idea was this would be a mobile rig, so you could have it running all the time, and it'd be a less than a half an amp draw on the battery to operate the solid state stages. But when you hit the push to talk button, boom, you get the full power to the rig. The transistors used throughout, there's only three or four kinds of transistors that are type by type number, and most of them are, all of them are in fact, are germanium, and that presents a problem because they're a four-wire germanium, which is an emitter base collector and a ground of the substrate. And these particular transistors, 2N2292s, are subject to aging. The germanium transistors, when they age, there's contaminants in there that essentially short out the transistor. And the fix to that, believe it or not, is to take the ground lead and cut it. And somehow, when you cut that ground lead, the substrate is not grounding out the transistor, and things will work.
Hey, Dean, you got to ask Claude about that, man. That's one for
I
Claude to
did. I
get
did. I
involved.
did. I did. I did post something on the blog, and it's a pretty cool design. There's some design features in the SBT3 that are rather unique. One, if you want to peak, like for instance, on the Tentec gear, they have a resonate control. If you want to peak the signal, they had a thumb wheel on the front panel, four thumb wheels in the front panel. So you didn't turn a knob like this. You just move the thumb wheel. And essentially, it biases some varactor diodes. So the two networks, the antenna passes through the PHY network of the transmit portion and some of the tuned circuits in the radio itself. This varactor diode will tune these coils. And it's kind of interesting. To get it on other bands with the band switch, they actually parallel two inductors, so it reduces the inductance for the higher frequencies. So when you move the band switch, that inductor's taken out, and essentially that coil is tuned for like 80 meters, so it's kind of unique. And here's another thing in there. There's no driver tube, which is a lot of the hybrid rigs that you saw in this area seem to have three tubes, a driver and two finals. This one actually took NPN. Well, these were NPN transistors. You can't even find these anymore, but they had them cascaded so that they developed enough RF to drive the solid state, or no, not the solid state, the instant heating 6146 like tubes. When I got it, I had a few problems. People did things to drill holes in the chassis, extra holes that didn't make any sense, and I had to fix those. I did manage to find, aside from the driver transistors, the actual transit PNP transistors, and I replaced a few of those. I could get it to work on 40 and 80 meters for the receive and transmit portion, but it didn't work too well on 80. Something kind of interesting too about the tubes, the 8042s. The filament voltage is 1.6 volts at 3 amps. So I mean, it's really strange. So you're drawing quite a bit of power when you turn the tubes on. So you have to, when you have a power supply, you know, like you can take a Drake supply or Heathkit supply, whatever. You can't just plug it in there. You have to have that. The filaments are in series, so you need about 3.2 volts at 3 amps to drive the filaments. So that means any supply you'd use has to be customized to provide that level. So I fixed the front panel, and I worked with it for almost a month, and I was not very successful in getting it to work on 80 meters, and it was just kind of marginally operated. So to really test it fully, I'd have to modify a supply. With some other things too, it needs about 250 volts on the screens, about 600 to 700 volts, 600 volts on the plates, and then this weird filament voltage and the bias voltage. So I just got to the point. I said, you know, it's going to be a lot of extra work, and I'm going to end up with something that's pretty marginal. So I've kind of cleaned it all up, put it in the box, and I just want to think about it for a little bit. It may not, it doesn't even go in the shelf of shame. It's just one of those things that doesn't make for good sense to proceed any further. You can understand why only 500 were built.
Yeah, you could.
Guys got them in on the show and went through the same thing with new radios, and then just finally. Now it's interesting. This was built in the San Diego area, and I took a good hard look. And at this time, in amateur radio history, San Diego was a hotbed of amateur radio products. These guys were building radios. For instance, you had Swan, you had the Cubic Corporation, you had Elda, you had Atlas, you had Transcom, and all these various other. And there was Palomar. They're all in the same area, so there's a lot of amateur radio manufacturing, and you can see things going around. The filter used in this radio is the same filter was in the Swan monobanders. I mean, it even looks the same. It's the same frequency, and it even looks the late looks the same with open and what have you. So I said, okay, he just found the guy that was building the Swan monobanders and pumped it into this radio. So it was has some very innovative techniques in it, but it also was not designed for maintenance. The VFO, if you want to do any work in the VFO, there was a blown RF choke in the VFO. You had to literally disassemble the radio to get to the board just so you could repair that choke. The driver board is mounted vertically up against the RF cage for the finals, and the bolts are almost inaccessible. So in other words, they installed the RF driver board and then they built the final parts around it. So I mean, there's components in a way to get to the head of the screw so you can get it out. And I say, who does things like that? Well, that's how they did things in those days.
Well, Pete, I think you're right. I think, I mean, this one sounds like a too long of a tale of woe.
I
So
don't know, Pete.
anyway,
I'm looking at a web page right now. It says the amazing Transcom SBT-3, one of ham radio's one-hit wonders. So you have a one-hit wonder there.
Well, that's why I bought it. I figured if I get this thing working, I paid quite a bit of money for it. I get this thing working, I can make a killing. I mean, a working radio's hoobus onto someone else. But anyway, it also
You
has
know,
taught me.
Pete, on the first project I built with you, the simple SSB, I got it working, and I was just delighted that I could hear anything, right, and say anything, and you said now you go from the wonder that it works at all to wondering if you can make it work right.
That's it. But this serves as a lesson to me. I got to stop taking on projects like this because you're going to invest a lot of time and a lot of money, and the final result may not be that satisfactory. I mean, it may work, but work marginally. Only 500 were built. Only 300 were bought by hams. Mine is serial number 44. So it was early in the construction, and I know there are some people that I know that actually have these radios, and their serial numbers are in the 200 and 300 range. So they have much later radios, and if there were issues, matter of fact, their front panels even a little bit different than mine, so they have some later refinements that, and the documentation is pretty sparse. It's just
It's
there's
also, Pete, it's telling. You and I were talking a little bit before the show that some very fine amateur home brewers that we know have had this rig and kind of gave up on it.
Yes.
That's a sign right there. You don't see too many people saying, I got this thing to work perfect, and I've been using it for the last 15 years on 75 meters. No.
That's right. So anyway, I need to wean myself of picking up projects like this and working on it because then you finally get to a point you just say, even if I get it working, it's going to be just somewhat marginal. So word to me, I keep telling myself, stop looking at eBay, stop buying this stuff. And if you're going to work on anything, work on something that you're building from scratch. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm building my next project is a 20 meter version of the hybrid wireless set. The 40-meter version works really well, but it's all on a board and what have you. So now I want to try to build a 20-meter version. It's a little more compact and has a little more power output. So that I've concluded that's where I'm headed. And why a two? Well, I'm getting to the stage now. I built close to 60 transceivers. This is the 20-meter hybrid is going to be number 60. And I'm just saying, how many more are you going to build? So if I'm going to kind of wean myself of building any more projects, it seems fitting that I build something with vacuum tubes, since that's the way I started out with this. But lots of fun. And but I've noticed some things, and I wanted to comment on any kind of building today. Tariffs. These tariffs are nuts. I went to buy some IRF 510s. There's a 20% tariff on it. So you're saying it should have cost me $10. It's now costing me $12. And I'm saying, what more am I getting for this extra $2? And where is that? No company is paying that. I'm paying it. And that's going to seriously impact our hobby. I mean, if you do a lot of home brewing, look at your bill and you'll see 20% tariff is just being passed on to us as home brewers. So I
Yeah.
just wonder what good that is. Have you seen that? Have you seen the tariffs?
I have. And on Mauser now, you'll get a little warning on parts that they'll say may be subject to tariff. And you won't know until you kind of go through the whole checkout what they're going to ding you for.
Yeah, well, I mean, no one is going to be. I mean, I can see the incentive of tariffs. American manufacturers will be spurred to build these products locally. Who's going to start an IRF 510 line in the United States? I mean,
Yeah.
the cost of they can't produce them for $1 a piece. I mean, it'd be $2.50 a piece that they would have to expend to build those, and then they're not competitive worldwide because they can't rely just on the American market. So, I mean, who are we kidding? You just pay the tariff and you get no value for it. I mean, if
Well,
it was.
they can tariff all the Bojack IRF 510s they want. They can put a
Yes!
1,000% tariff on
Yes!
those because they don't
Yes!
work as
Yes!
amplifiers.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
I was forced to make the assertion that Bojack FETs are bogus.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, but Pete,
Yeah.
I think you're right. It makes sense to choose wisely when you're starting a
Yes.
project, and it makes I think it would also make sense, and I found this to be satisfying, is that to build something that you know is going to work. And then, but then use it quite a bit. Like I got on 15 meters yesterday, and I worked a guy that I hadn't talked to in many years. And well, let me just see if I got his call sign here. I got my notepads here, but yeah, I talked to Dave N4KZ, and I hadn't talked to him in years. And we just got on and we started talking about older rigs and Hammerlands and Hallicrafters and Gene Shepherd, and one thing led to another. This was all on 15 meters with my very simple little 15 meter rig here. And it was just great fun. So I think the thing to do is build something that you know is going to work. I mean, you're going to have to tinker with it every once in a while. It's
Oh,
going to
yeah.
break on you, but it's going to actually work, unlike the Transcom receiver that you have sitting there behind you. So I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing that. And man, you've already built 60 receivers, 60 transceivers,
Yeah.
61.
Who knew you were? Hey, while I'm on it, and one of the things I want to include on the 20-meter version of the hybrid wireless is the JF3HZB circular dial.
Oh, they're really cool.
And they're really cool. And Dean, this is an input to you, and I'll talk to you more offline, but I have been trying to modify the sketch, and it's the ESP32 sketch is a little different from what you normally see with the Arduino type sketches. And so it's some of it is my unfamiliarity. One thing I've been able to successfully do, hit a toggle switch, and I can change the panel from, it'll say upper sideband to lower sideband. So I'm able with a switch, I'm able to select, I'm able to produce on the screen it says upper sideband and lower sideband. But I've been having a devil of a time shifting the BFO from the one frequency it's in the sketch to the second frequency. I've tried all sorts of things, so I'll talk to you offline, but that would be really
I got
useful
it.
too.
I got my mock-up of it right here, Pete.
Yeah. Yeah,
So,
I'll send you the sketch. I was able to recognize. I mean, that to me, that was a big throw. Throw the switch and the display changes. Hey, you should be able to plug different numbers in there. And if I can do that, it'd be really cool. It's not too important on the 20 meter, but it'd be nice on the 40 meter version, because then upper sideband lets you work FT8 on the 40 meters. I'll send you the sketch and maybe you can look at it and say you need to do this instead of this. But I mean, it's just, I know what to do if on an Arduino sketch, and I've done it, hundreds of times, but this is a little bit different. But it'd be kind of nice to do that. And that dial with a 3.2-inch display is just, you sit there and watch those numbers go by, and it's just like having a retro radio. I mean, you play with it a bit, and isn't that kind of amazing than just some digital readout,
It's really,
It's a
really
thing of
cool.
beauty.
It's a thing of
Yeah.
beauty. It is.
Yeah. So, and then one final word is the other thing I saw on my trip. I've never seen so many weird tattoos in Wales, and I'll say no more than that. But man, this just you see something in the Midwest. There's lots of tattoos on YLs, and some of them are really graffiti. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you very much. And good. I think you're wise to make good decisions here. Pick your projects, pick them carefully. Pete, this is
Yeah.
time for what time is it in the show now?
Shameless Commerce
It
Division.
is time for the Shameless Commerce Division, and we're going to start today by just saying fight the AI apocalypse. And the way you could do that is by becoming a Patreon sponsor of the Solder Smoke blog and podcast. Become a sponsor, a Patreon sponsor. You could find it in the upper left-hand corner of our still existent Google Blogspot blog. There it is. It'll tell you how to become a Patreon sponsor. It's very helpful, and it's a good way to fight the AI apocalypse. The other way to fight the AI apocalypse is to strike back against Pete's good friend Bezos, and Bezos's now his wife, right?
Yeah.
Mrs. Bezos. Get them to send us some Bezos bucks by using the Amazon link on the upper right-hand side of the page. If you click on that link and then you go into the Amazon world, anything you buy there will cause Bezos to send us some money, which is very helpful, which we like to receive it. We collect it. So go ahead and do that. And finally,
I had a first, Bill.
what was that?
I received a refund from Amazon for a product that I did not request a refund on. And I went through chatbot hell trying to contact a live customer service rep
You
at
tried.
Amazon. You can eventually do it. If you dig deep enough, there's actually a place where you can click and say, "Call me back." And I got somebody at a call center somewhere on some far remote part of the world, and he heard my question. I'm like, "Wait, you got money and you want to give it back?" I said, "Well, I didn't request a refund." And he said, "Well, let me put you on hold a little bit." And he came back and he said, "You can keep it and you don't need to send the part back."
All right, so there's one for our side. Very good. And listen, the final part of Shameless Commerce Division is buy parts and stuff and boards from Todd K7TFC up there in the Silicon Forest of Portland, Oregon, and his company is mostly DIYRF. You could reach it by clicking on the picture on the right-hand side of the blog. There it is. Great stuff. Todd is always coming out with some great components and really, really good stuff. So mostly DIYRF. Very good. Hey, listen, this gets to my portion of the show, and I am going to make comments on things that are related to what you guys have said. First, I managed to blow up and release the magic smoke from two, count them, two RD06s in two separate rigs. That's quite a trick. How did I do that? There are two completely separate rigs. One covers 20 meters, one covers 10 and 15. They both have RD06s in the final. And I did something stupid and released smoke in both of those transistors. So here's how it started. It all started with a problem that developed in my CCI amp. See, both of these transceivers switch and feed into the CCI amp, depending on which band I'm going to use. The CCI amp started giving me trouble. It was like intermittent. Like sometimes it would amplify, sometimes it would not. Something was wrong in there. And I foolishly thought that maybe because I've been gone for 3 months, maybe the rigs themselves, the SSB transceivers, there's some little tiny little pots in there that set the drive level on the amplifier. They might have been wrong. So I went in there and I just was it was early one morning and I started fiddling with the pots, and I was actually fiddling with the bias level, not the drive level, the bias voltage on the RD6. Like, as Pete has told us, they are quite sensitive to having too much bias on them. And poof, poof, I let out magic smoke on two RD06s. I later found out that there was a problem with the CCI amp, but it was because the primary coil on the input was not grounding properly. So I grounded it properly and that problem was solved. But now I was pro faced with two dead RD06s. So I realized I searched my voluminous junk box here. I had no backup RD06s here in the shack. However, I had a number of old projects with IRF 510s in there. This caused me to ask Pete and Dean, all right, don't tell me about the current level. I know that we're supposed to measure the current, but just tell me what kind of voltage level, which is easier to measure, I should put on the gates of the IRF 510s. I also, yeah, that's exactly what I did. So I followed your advice, Pete, about 4 volts, 4.5, something like that. And but I also realized that the structure of the IRF 510 is different from the RD06, and you can't just bolt it to the heat sink because then you'll be grounding your drain. You have to put a mica insulator. Thank God I had an insulator kit here. So I put two of them together. I put two IRF 510s in there, and Bob is my uncle, and I got them both on the air. So now I'm on 15, 10, and 20 meters using the CCI amps and the IRF 510s. And Dean, I hate to say it, but I'm getting pretty good output on all three bands. It's up in the 100 watt range.
Do not apologize for your success.
I know.
I can't tell you how much pleasure I get from hearing that you two have blown up. Now, you did not blow up a $50 transistor. You only blew up a $13 transistor.
I know, and
But
but then it was quite a job to extract the IRF 510s from the rigs that were in there, and from the rigs in which they were placed, and that was kind of rough. But I got on the air, and I've been on 20 single sideband with this rig, and I've worked into VK6. VK6 comes booming in. This is VK6. I'm used to thinking all the VK6s are all down by Perth. This is VK6 JMS. He's up in the northern part of Western Australia in an area known as the Kimberley, and he's making use of the HCJB antennas, the shortwave broadcast antennas. He was beaming at 80 degrees, which is aimed pretty much right at me. And I worked him. I worked him several times on 20 meters. That's really been a lot of fun. Inspired by Pete, I started working on my old HW101. My old HW101 transceiver, because Pete started talking about old hybrid rigs, and that made me think, okay, I'm going to pull it out. I worked on the power supply, got the power supply up to snuff. I did not electrocute myself, which was really quite a chore given all my years of working on 12 volt transistors. But inspired by Pete and also by Will, N5OLA, who's down there on South Padre Island in Texas, he's the guy who gives the old HW101s literally a bath. He puts a whole bunch of water in there. Whoa, I know, I had the same reaction. But Will seems like he really knows what he's doing. And he does, after bathing the HW101s, he puts them in the oven,
Bakes them.
bakes them in the oven in the kitchen, and lives to tell about this. You know, I none of I would not. I would This would be the end of me if I
He
started
does a
putting.
two-stage bake, though. He puts them outside for 2 days.
And then he leaves them in the sun in South Padre Island for a couple of days just to make sure there's no water left. Anyway, I found that all very inspirational, what Pete said and what Will WN5OLA said. Also, I want to make a comment. This gets back to the direct conversion receivers that we've been working on. So we started hearing from some of the builders that they did not like the hiss coming out of the receivers. And our first reaction was, oh, come on, you know, deal with it. 40 meter receivers have some hiss. It's called band noise. It's not like the iPhone. It's not like the TikTok video. It hisses a little bit. But then The guy, one of the guys who was talking about it was a little bit more persistent, and he was saying, "No, wait a second. I am hearing high frequency hiss and high frequency signals up at around 5 kc, right? Wait a second." I started thinking, "Hey, I can't even hear 5 kc because the U.S. Army has installed in my ears some low pass filters with cutoffs at about 3 kHz, right?" So then I did a test. They gave me some hearing aids. I put them in and I did a hearing test like before and after. And sure enough, without the hearing aids, I couldn't hear 5 kHz at all. With the hearing aids, I could hear 5 kHz. So this caused me to sort of repent and reconsider my harsh attitude towards these folks and say, yeah, if you have sort of normal hearing and hearing of a younger person, you could be bothered by this high frequency hiss. So I actually built a filter, a low pass filter, using an 88 millihenry choke.
Ooh.
Pete, you remember those? Those are the ones we used to
Yeah.
take out of the phone system, right? I had several of them, and I put a filter in there, and I had a little switch on the back of the receiver, and I could switch it in, and boom, it would knock down the high frequency hiss. So anyway, I think high frequency hearing loss has to be considered when you're working on direct conversion receivers. Let's see what else I
And
can do.
I built an op amp version of that filter, and I put it in with the same thing. And I have to tell you that, yeah, there is a little bit of high frequency hiss. I still like the unfiltered sound of a direct conversion receiver better.
I do too. And I find myself saying, okay, yeah, there I get it off, but I could knock down the 5 kHz, but I find myself running the receiver more frequently with the thing turned off. I like to listen. The thing about about the direct conversion receiver is that it's unfettered. It's just out there. It's closer to the ether. So there it is. But anyway, I mean, there are some guys who are bothered by this and okay. I am not bothered because, like I say, I have these low pass filters already installed in my head. Hey,
Okay.
I made you know, one of the other points that we've been making with the guys who are building these receivers is that these receivers, although quite simple, are not toys. They actually can be used on the air, and it's been very encouraging to see a number of the builders go out there and turn these receivers into transceivers, double sideband, and lately CW transceivers. But I went ahead and hooked up my tuna tin 2 transmitter, which was made on a real tuna tin, and hook it up with the 40 meter direct conversion receiver and go on the air on 40 meters and see if I could work anybody. I made 11 contacts with this thing, right? I called CQ and Mike Bryce, WB8 VGE, who's a real kind of luminary in the QRP solar power POTA world, came back to my CQ. And we also made one contact. This was also really unbelievable with this receiver on both sides. K1OA built the solder smoke direct conversion receiver. He was using it. I built the solder smoke direct conversion receiver and I was using it. We actually made a contact, a CW contact, with solder smoke direct conversion receivers on both sides. So that was pretty cool. 11 contacts. I've retired it for the moment. I didn't bring it with me here, but it was great fun. Now I have a final question for you guys, and I'd like to hear what both of you think. But ALC, one of the things I discovered when I was working with the HW101 is that it has this thing in on the transmit circuitry. ALC. ALC seems to be the equivalent of AGC. Now, we all said we're not going to do AGC a while back because real hams control their own receiver gain. Wow, my mind was blown by the fact that I found in the HW101 ALC circuits, which is sort of the transmit equivalent of the AGC. And I started feeling bad about it. I started thinking, well, I built all these transceivers, not one of them has ALC in it. But then I figured out a way that you could sort of just do in a simple way what the ALC circuit is supposed to do. And that is, I hooked up an oscilloscope and I just coupled it loosely to the output of the transmitter. And as I'm talking to, my old friend N4KZ or whoever, I just occasionally glance over at the oscilloscope and make sure I'm not flat topping, all right? And I think that that is sort of a simple way around the question of do I need ALC? What do you think, Pete?
That's the way.
That's the way of doing it. Yeah.
That's what I do.
That's what you're good. All right.
Yeah, that's what I do. And the reason is you rely on that ALC circuit, but it may not be adjusted properly. You think, well, I got ALC, not a problem.
Well,
But
not only that,
monitor
with the ALC, if you crank it up too high, you're getting a lot of compression,
it.
and
Right.
it's just compressing, and it's making a whole lot. The IMD products are worse. Everything is
Right.
there.
Look at it
So
on scope, continuous monitoring.
that's
What I
it.
do is usually in the low pass filter, I put a one turn loop,
Yep.
on the scope probe, and you're there, and
Yeah.
I can
Well,
watch it all the time.
that's it. What do you think, Dean?
I think that the RF trace showing the audio waveform bouncing up and down as you speak is just magical to watch.
I love it. I do.
I
I
love
like
it.
watching it
It's,
too. Yeah. And not only that,
yeah.
it gives you it'll it, the Regal scopes that we have will give you the RMS reading too.
Yeah.
Wow, look at that. I'm putting out 80 volts RMS. Woo-hoo! That's it. All right, good. I'm glad you guys confirmed that. All right, so we got this is time for the Satterbrook mailbag. We're moving right
So,
along here.
Bill, I'm going to let you do the mailbag. I have to run.
You
So
have
I'm
to
going to say
run.
7-3, guys. I'll let you guys finish up.
We'll finish up. Thanks, Dane. Thanks a
All
lot.
right. Bye-bye.
Take
Bye-bye.
care. Bye-bye. All right. So the first one in the mailbag we got was from the Project 326 guy. This was a guy who put out a video, and he's a British engineer, and his video was so cool. It was about how to make an X-ray machine powered by a USB connector. So you plug it into the USB connector, one end, and out comes X-rays. This reminded me of the old C.L. Stong articles about homebrew X-ray machine. So I said to myself, "Who is this guy?" Because he sounded like he was coming from China, but he sounded British. So I put out a message on the Solder Smoke blog. I said, "Who is this masked man?" And it turns out that he is a British engineer resident in China for the last 20 years. So he's a good guy to know, and I'm glad that he responded to the Solder Smoke blog there. We also heard from Steve EI5 Delta Delta. He's the guy who's responsible for that wonderful magazine, Ham Radio Ireland. It's an online magazine. It's free. It's got a lot of good information in there, and I posted it on the blog. But this caused me to make a question, and I sent this question to Steve. Hey, why are there no Irish solder smoke direct conversion receiver builders? We've got this thing built in 15 countries. Not one has been built in Ireland. So we need an Irish builder there. Got a nice message from Paul, K9ARF. He wrote a very kind email about how much solder smoke, the blog, the podcast, and the book have meant to him. And I liked it so much, I actually put it up on the Solder Smoke blog. So you guys want to take a look at that. Thanks very much to Paul for sending that to us. Roger, PA1 Zulu Zulu, has sent us many nice videos and a lot of good information on how to do a backup for the blog. One of the more recent ones that Roger sent me was the YouTube video about Is the Internet Dying? And it has to do with the AI apocalypse and all that. And I had to put a note below it saying that Roger, by the way, is real. He is not a bot. So we got that clarified. Grayson, KJ7UM, responded to a blog post about the EF50 valve. I have a link up on the show notes here. He would refer to it, of course, as a Thermotron, but a very cool looking valve that was produced during World War II in the UK. Bruce KC1FSZ, he nominated us for the ARRL award. Thank you for doing that, Bruce. But he's also got four solder smoke direct conversion receiver builders in the Wesley, Massachusetts Radio Club. Wesley, we need that. We need that with the MIT Wesley. It'd be kind of role. We need four builders because we're shooting for 100 builds. We're at 91 or 92 now. And we need some more. So keep good luck with that. Chris, KD4 PBJ, took a long trip to pick up two directional beacons that he plans on putting on either 630 meters or 2200 meter bands. Whoa. Pete's astonished. The 2,200 meter band.
The antenna's 8 miles long. The dipole's 8 miles long.
Chris. Chris has said that that he, because of projects like this, he's been delayed in building his direct conversion receiver. Okay, Chris. But again, we need receiver builders. So get with it. Quit fooling around with that 2,300 meter stuff, 2,200 meter stuff. Alan, W2AEW did a really rigorous minimum discernible signal test on the DCRX. Very fine business, Alan. Thanks for doing that. And it just confirmed our suspicion that this is a remarkably sensitive receiver, even though it's double sideband, even though it's simple as can be. It's got no RF amplification ahead of the mixer. It's good stuff. I mean, it's very, very basic, but also very, very sensitive. Mike WN2A, he put many great comments in there about how to do the minimum discernible signal test and in its various forms. I think a lot of us just do it on an audio basis. We just listen and say, okay, as I move the signal generator up and down in frequency around the frequency that I've tuned, can I hear it? But of course, there are more rigorous ways of doing it. Alan did it in a much more rigorous way. He looked for a 3 dB increase in audio output. Thanks to Mike for pointing out the differences in MDS measurement techniques. Felipe, Fox 6 Golf Uniform Hotel is a truly fine business home brewer. I put a link up to him on the Solder Smoke blog. You could find it there. I spoke to Mike EI0CL. It's always great to talk with an old friend. I've been talking to Mike since at least the year 2000. I was in the Azores. Mike is it was in Ireland, and Mike was also in Canary Islands in Echo Alpha 8 land, and it was both within range of my 17 meter rig. So we started talking to Mike, a truly wonderful ham radio guy, a true builder and experimenter. So it's always good. And I managed to talk to him again recently. Walter KA4KXX is down there in Orlando. And Walter has been encouraging me for a long time to check into their early morning, what they call sunrise net on 40 meters CW. And I never quite had the capability until I got the HW101 fixed up and it was ready to go. So I waited, and I checked in. Walter doesn't check in every single time, but he always gets a report on the check-ins. And he sent me a couple of days later this really nice email saying that he was delighted to see my call sign in amongst the check-ins there on the Sunrise Net. So thanks, Walter. We got a good email from our good friend Farhan VU2ESE. He was watching our interview with Phil W1PJE, and then I got a nice picture and an email from Phil. Phil was a shortwave listener, and he used his grandfather's old Hallicrafters receiver, and he sent a picture of it. He's holding the receiver. It's huge, and he's holding it in front of the dome, the observatory dome at the Haystack Observatory. He also comments about how when he was a kid, he used to listen to Voice of America, and he wrote to them, and he requested a QSL card, and they wrote back to him saying no, they weren't going to send him a QSL card, because they don't send QSL cards to American citizens. That would be propaganda. Boo, boo. I said boo on VOA. What a bunch of.
There is no more VOA. Is that right? It's gone away.
I think they're gone. Hey, but Radio Marti is back. Surprise, surprise. We couldn't live without Radio Marti. Radio Marti was our nemesis above the high end of the 40 meter band, but it's back. Yeah, all right. Also, this is related to what Phil works on. I was listening to a podcast, another podcast by Fraser Crane, Universe Today. It's a great podcast. And Fraser was talking about how the hydrogen line from the cosmic dark ages, with a few hundred year thousand years after, no, a few million years, I think it is, after the Big Bang, but way back then, has been redshifted over time. And it is now coming out, it is now detectable on Earth at, guess what frequency? Just above 7 megahertz. So that happens to be in the range of our direct conversion receiver. So I guess, guys, the answer is listen up. Listen up, up, up in frequency. Hey, Pete, that's all I have for Cider Smoke this week. How about you?
I'm good.
All right. Well, thanks for getting up so early in the morning. It's really early for Pete there. And thanks to all the listeners. And I'll just say 7-3 from the Dominican Republic.
73's from the left coast.
Thanks a lot, Pete.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye.